Hi, welcome to the CTO to CTO podcast. In this week's Balance It episode, I speak to Angela Ortiz, social impact and sustainability entrepreneur. Angela is the author of 8 Principles That Will Make You an Effective Leader in Social Impact and has over 9 years of experience in CSR. Her company, Stratacus Consulting, specializes in providing savvy solutions for companies and SMEs that help them enable effective CSR strategies and social impact programs. Today, Angela talks about her journey from volunteer for local communities affected by the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in the Honshu region of Japan through CSR manager and advisor for H&M and Adidas to building her own CSR consulting company in 2021. She discusses the most difficult obstacles both large and small companies face when building their sustainability program, employee engagement, and explains how to effectively align your impact initiatives with your line of business. Tune in. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the CTO to CTO podcast, to the Balance It series. My guest is Angela Ortiz today. Hello, Angela.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Angela Ortiz is a dynamic and authentic social impact professional with over 9 years of experience across business sectors and cultures. She's an in-demand public speaker that has recently published a book on leadership and social impact titled Place to Grow, the 8 Principles That Will Make You an Effective Leader in Social Impact. She founded and leads a community-building nonprofit, Place to Grow, established in the aftermath of the 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown. In addition, she has over 6 years of experience in corporate social responsibility, leading initiatives with various global companies like the fashion retailer H&M and the iconic sports brand Adidas. So, thank you, Angela, once again for joining me today in the Balance It series. Is there anything that you would like to tell us before we get into the heavy topics of CSR? Maybe something that I haven't mentioned about your experience or professional or private life that you'd like to give us a little bit of background on?
I guess I could share that I am a Colombian American ethnic background, but have been living in Japan and Tokyo mostly for the last almost 30 years. So that's an interesting like cross-cultural background from myself. I was a single mother for most of my adult life and recently got engaged. And now, so together we have 4 daughters all in their early 20s. And I am just starting on a new sort of part of my life in the consulting space around social impact and sustainability.
Amazing. So first of all, a very diverse cultural background and perspective, because you bring that all into Japan, which is also an extremely rich culture in itself, and huge family. Did you say 4 daughters at the moment?
Yeah, together.
Together. Okay. And congratulations on the engagement. So let me start with the first question that we've prepared. Tell us more about your overall experience with CSR, so corporate social responsibility. I have noted down that your first major job in CSR was the H&M job, but maybe there was something before that. So tell us a bit more about your first experiences.
So prior to H&M, I had become kind of by accident a point person for CSR program development for many corporations who were exploring this new phenomenon in Tokyo and in Japan called corporate employee volunteering. And this happened obviously in the aftermath of the 2011 disaster in North Japan. And so a lot of companies' CSR was sort of kickstarted into action, and they were constantly going to the devastated areas and they were looking for programs, they were looking for partners and activities. So it was almost like consulting in a way. It was just like project-based work.
Okay.
And that led me actually, that was the first time I heard about this term CSR or social impact in a sort of business, mm-hmm. from a mm-hmm. business sense. But that led me to become very mm-hmm. interested in the subject, and that led me to study it more. And then that led me into having the opportunity to put my hand up and apply for the H&M role. And a funny thing was, in mm-hmm. my role in nonprofit, I had been giving a lecture on social impact and volunteering, and it was the CEO of H&M at the time that was in that room. Later, like 6 months down the line, we met in the interview and she remembered me. And I think that was probably one of the reasons that I was hired. because she had sort of seen me in action and I was giving a speech on something.
Okay.
So that was quite, I guess it's not a very traditional slide into the field, but also sustainability, social impact. It's also quite a new sector that I don't know many leaders in the field now that kind of went the traditional route, like you study in university and maybe do an internship. And so that's just sort of how I ended up there.
Can you tell us a bit more about the type of projects you did at H&M?
Absolutely. One of the first projects I was in charge of was their Close the Loop program. So they had launched this globally and it was their first consumer-facing recycling program where customers could return unwanted items, not just H&M branded products, but any sort of textiles, even sheets, towels, etc. And H&M had a partnership with a recycling company, a global recycling company, and that allowed them to ensure that nothing was going into landfill or being burned. What I did for that was really step in and help global and local alignment. So in Japan, we named this project it was called Close the Loop to the Consumers, but for the employees, I named it the Recyclers. And we had to set up like a huge education program because a lot of our employees didn't know why we were doing this. They didn't know what was happening. And because Japan is a developed country, you know, most of our employees had very little experience with, you know, no running water or what happens when water routes get contaminated. They don't understand a lot of the issues in the supply chain. They don't understand the needs for like strong human rights policies. So I basically had to visit every single shop. We had, I think, about 70 shops around Japan at that time. And I spent almost a full year going to every single shop, having meetings with the manager, having meetings with the recyclers. We put two in each store. And these were designated employees that would know more than the average employee on our environmental and social sustainability policies. I also had to then manage like the logistics of how many kilos, how many tons were we collecting every year. The way H&M had it set up, the partnership with the recycling company actually generated an income. So for every kilo, it wasn't a lot, like, you know, it was a couple cents or something. But this income was then put into like a charity account. And then we would donate that to an NPO we felt was within the scope of the problems that H&M was trying to find solutions for.
Did I get the timeline correctly? You said this is somewhere around 2010-11?
No, this was 2016. So I started in the nonprofit sector in 2011 and then moved fully into the CSR corporate sector in 2016, January, actually.
Okay. Because I was going to say this sounds still very forward comparing to what a lot of companies are doing at the moment now. It only feels like the major brands are catching on to, recycling, reusing, pretty much now in 2020, 21, I can see it as more of a trend. Yeah. So that's amazing that you were part of that.
It's so funny because just this morning I was reading some articles on this and I noticed that on my social media feed, specifically like Facebook and Instagram, I'm constantly seeing like ads for get your sustainability degree or look at what this company is doing over here. And I was thinking like, wow, when I started at H&M, one, you didn't see any of that. And two, I remember being in rooms where people looked at me and was like, but why should we do this? Like, why is it important? So in addition to employee training, I did a lot of public speaking and working with stakeholders, like our business partners, for example, our landlords, because we had very clear benchmarks from Global on how to reduce our carbon footprint or reduce our energy intake. And this required conversations with our landlords and different business partners that we had, right, in order to get them to cooperate so that we could achieve some of these goals. And at that time, you know, I was hit with that like, oh, well, it's very nice to do. It's very admirable that you want to do these things for the environment, but where's the business sense in it?
Have fun with your little project, right? Yeah.
A lot of sort of like head patting and nodding and And now it's like I see all their mission statements on their websites, and I'm kind of like,
interesting.
But I told you
but
so.
But it's also such an amazing one of those trends that you're really glad to see, right? And I really don't care, you know, what's the motivation. If the motivation is to look good for your customers or to go with the tide, it doesn't really matter. It's all about the fact that companies are making a real change. And it's all thanks to the education and the perseverance of people like you who were there at the very beginning saying, hello, it's high time that we start these kinds of initiatives. Yeah. Okay. So what came after H&M? Was it Adidas?
Yes. So with Adidas, I moved there because the role they needed was someone to specifically create a strategy for Adidas Japan's CSR. And my heart really lies in strategy and the big picture thinking. And because I, through my nonprofit world and then, of course, with H&M, I had a really large network. And I was very excited about doing something like a cross-sector project that we could actually like pick one issue and try and overcome that. Also, the Olympics was on the horizon, and so I was excited about working with Adidas. Also, I've just been a fan since I was a kid. And so that was very exciting. So I moved into the business development team there and got to work like right with the CEOs, sort of what they call in Japan, the shachoshitsu, which is like the president's team. So we're helping him manage various aspects of the entire company. And it was really exciting for them to put sustainability right there at the top. And so for them, what I did, of course, I'm doing employee engagement again. They had a lot of projects using sport to rebuild community in the north of Japan, where I was already working as a volunteer. So that was just like a dream come true to be able to support them in a much more powerful way with a lot more money and a lot of, you know, bigger names. We had athletes go up there and run workshops for the community. But one of the biggest things that I thought was really cool was because of my experience at H&M with this Close the Loop program, I was able to roll out the Take Back program for Adidas Japan, which was essentially the same concept, except Adidas was also accepting shoes. And that was really needed because H&M's partnership with the German recycling company is called iCollect, but they weren't able to recycle shoes. You know, the technology wasn't quite there yet because it's a lot more difficult to recycle shoes. And so we rolled that out and we were able to accept shoes as well. And that was just really cool. I felt like I was able to use all of my experience and help Adidas make a bigger impact here.
Okay. Okay. I'm wondering because at the beginning you mentioned I was already volunteering there. Is now the right time to start talking about your volunteering work? I feel like it is.
Sure. It's very intertwined.
Yes.
So in 2011, I moved to Miyagi, a little town called Minami Sandiku, as a first responder. And we were doing things like delivering food and water. We worked alongside the Japan Self-Defense Force to reestablish the lifeline for the displaced local residents. In 2013, so two years later, we moved into economic enhancement. So we were working with companies, and this is where I started to learn about CSR, to help kickstart or rebuild the economy. So small businesses, helping get funds for farmers specifically, so also a bit with the fishing industry. And then I realized as the infrastructure was rebuilt, the big need was the community rebuildment. So it's those soft skills because they lost so many people, right? There was massive emotional impact to the community and the survivors. So that's when I rebranded the organization to Place to Grow, a community building nonprofit. And that was the same year that I moved into H&M. And so I went from a sort of more standard nonprofit or structure where I was getting a salary into 100% nonprofit. And we organized fitness events and language exchange events for children throughout the year. And then at the end of the year, we had a sort of a cross-community project where schools would exchange greeting cards with families in the displaced areas. And volunteers would go up there and sing and dance and eat cake and give out presents and just like a lot of inspiration to sort of help rebuild their mm-hmm. the emotional fabric of the community. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I continued this volunteer work mm-hmm. as I was working for H&M and then as I was working for Adidas. And the Adidas project, it was a marathon, like helping the city rebuild a marathon. It was literally like 20 kilometers north of where my nonprofit base was.
Okay. So I know we keep taking a step back here, but because our podcast is basically based in Poland and we have a lot of European listeners, mainly some in the US, maybe because I'm sure, you know, all of our listeners know that in 2011 there was an earthquake in Japan, but maybe can you tell our listeners a bit more detail of what was the impact, where it was exactly, and why you got involved in the rebuilding of the community in the first place?
I will try to keep this short.
Yeah.
Basically, yes. So in March 11, 2011, there was a huge earthquake off the coast of North Japan. We call that area Tohoku. And that sparked the largest tsunami in history, basically, in Japan. The earthquake was the fifth largest in the history of the world, the most financially devastating for Japan. But to give you a little bit of context, it actually moved the Earth's axis about 5 centimeters, and the whole island of Japan was moved 8 feet closer to California.
Wow.
So it was a catastrophic disaster. The tsunami came in. They were told it was going to be a high tsunami, like a big one, maybe 6 meters. What ended up happening in the highest reaching place, it was 40 meters high.
Oh my goodness.
So entire communities that were not even prepared for tsunamis because usually they're not at risk were just swept away. And then the tsunami hit the nuclear reactor in Fukushima and that exploded. So now we had a nuclear disaster on our hands. So there was basically three. There was earthquake, a tidal wave, and then a nuclear reactor had exploded. In all, there were about, I think it was just under 20,000 people that perished. And in the years after that, almost, I think it was like Fukushima that lost as many people. It was just about 1,500. They lost about 1,500 in that one town. But then the next year, because so much infrastructure was gone and people are living in such depressing situations, we lost the same amount of people to depression, to suicide, to ill health brought on by the emotional duress. It took them 3 years just to like sweep up the rubble. And this year, on the 10th year, they finally said, okay, we have recovered to a degree where everyone's out of temporary housing and has been able to be moved into sort of government housing spaces. Yeah. But I cycled the coast last October, and I still saw people living in temporary housings. So needless to say, it was one of the most devastating incidences for Japan after World War II, mm-hmm. is what the prime minister at the time said. Mm-hmm. I got involved because my parents live in the northernmost city of the Japan island, the Honshu island. And by chance, I knew someone in that town. Mm-hmm. And had gotten in touch with him, had went down with a truck full of supplies. And then one thing just led to another and I ended up starting a nonprofit there.
Thank you. Thank you for that, because that really sets the tone, I think, for this conversation and also explains your involvement in all of these initiatives. And this is very intense for a very, very small scale. I can only imagine the trauma that people have gone through. So even more respect to you for stepping in right away and also not doing that just for a moment while everyone is talking about it and while, you know, the most basic necessities are needed, but you also refocused your career at that point, I have a feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. My background's in education, so I was a kindergarten teacher in Tokyo before this. But, the devastation was definitely like the catalyst for me to go, oh my God, what happened here? And I've never seen anything like it. It was so emotionally traumatizing. And then I think it was, you know, the hopelessness that made me continue on. But then I was also very surprised to about how much I learned in those first couple months as a volunteer. And so there was also this sense of like, this is an opportunity for me to completely grow as a professional. And then who would have, you know, I could never have foreseen that that action would have then led to me learning about sustainability and social impact. And then that eventually led to a completely new career. So I always looked at volunteering, not so much from a top down like aid or I'm here to help them, but there was so much for me to learn and so much benefit to my life from those actions. I mean, it was really difficult. Don't get me wrong. There were a lot of crazy stories and moments, but you can read about that in my book, actually. There's a lot in that book about that, those years, if you want some crazy stories.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So just a reminder for all our listeners, the book is called Place to Grow, The 8 Principles That Will Make You an Effective Leader in Social Impact. And I'm sure it's available on Amazon.
It is. Yep.
Okay. So we've spoken about the tsunami, the earthquake, the devastation. Then we spoke about your first steps in CSR, H&M, Adidas. And fast forward to that moment now. What happens after Adidas? Where does your career continue?
So with Adidas, another thing that I really worked on for them, as I mentioned in the beginning, right, was that cross-sector stakeholder engagement. Of course, the company's agenda was to be seen as a leader in sustainability. And the best way to do that was to get out there and start talking to people about what we wanted to do and how we wanted to move forward. Now, COVID really came and changed all of that. A lot of the programs that I had spent almost 2 years building, you know, building relationship with the Japanese government, for example, and the different prefectures, it was all gone. Everything was canceled. Everything was pushed back. And in that process, also the restructuring of the company. So I left just a few months ago, though. It was March of this year that I resigned. And one of the things one of the challenges of corporate social responsibility is that along with the things that are in my like zone of my genius zone, you know, like I think in corporate, they call this like your area of expertise. Along with all of that, you have to do a lot of the stuff, you know, a lot of the admin work, a lot of the meetings after meetings, trying to convince people that this is the direction we should go in. So I was a little bit relieved to say, oh, well, I don't have to do this anymore. Moving into consulting. So I founded the Strategist Corporate Consulting, and Strategist stands for, it's like a mix between strategy and techniques. Because I saw a need in the corporate world for people to actually have techniques. There's a lot of strategy around sustainability, and we have a lot of moonshots to go, you know, 100% circular and renewable. We have moonshots for going carbon free or, you know, reducing our carbon footprint by 2030. But your average corporate manager has absolutely no techniques or know-how to implement those things. So that's what I'm moving into right now, is to help pinpoint more like on a project base, companies that already have a vision and now they're just looking for some of that, like, how do we actually do this? What are those techniques we can use? Whether that is, how do I get my, you know, my leadership involved, or how do we create a public face on this? Stakeholder engagement, that's something that a lot of people struggle with, how to work across sectors, how to work with, let's say, like the governments, because they work on a very different sort of rhythm than corporates.
Who is the potential client of Strategist? Is it pretty much any manager, CEO, founder of a startup, anyone who wants to involve their company in CSR, or is it a specific type of company or client?
No, it really is. So there's two services I provide, right? One is the sort of consulting on a project basis. So it would be almost any company that needs to do a social impact project here in Japan, and they need to figure out who are the best partners for their business and who should they be working with. Uh-huh. So that would be your Adidas's, your H&M's, or your SMEs, or even your startups. Mm-hmm. The other service I do is actually CSR training. So it would be probably the payment would come from the CEO, but it would basically be your struggling CSR manager that is trying to figure out how to engage cross-sector.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so they can take my course. It's a 6-week course. And I basically run through like the really practical aspects of like, okay, so you're supposed to align your marketing team with your HR team and you need to get employee volunteers. I spent years running around in circles and learning about like why people don't get involved. And you might have a top-down mission statement from the CEO, but your marketing team really doesn't do anything mm-hmm. with this, mm-hmm. or it's the opposite, mm-hmm. right? So there's a lot of, I guess, you know, we're still figuring it out, right? All of society is still figuring it out. So there's a lot of inefficient areas that I would just love to sort of step in there and be like, okay, do this. Here's the strategy. Here's the technique.
Okay. And what's the biggest struggle? Is it people not caring, or is it their lack of understanding why is this important, or the lack of follow-up? Like, for example, they get excited, but then their enthusiasm dies very quickly.
Oh, it's actually all of the above. There's so many reasons for why people don't engage. And as I mentioned with H&M, for example, the employees just really not being able to relate to some of the issues. A lot of times it's deprioritized by higher management, and this is because it isn't aligned with the business. So they look at it as a nice to have rather than part of their business offering. A lot of times people are overworked and they are busy. So they, you know, they get excited, but then it's hard to follow up. They don't have a lot of time. And then because it's not prioritized or aligned with the business, what happens is the CSR manager ends up just creating events that are fun and maybe exciting and maybe it's educational in the moment, but you don't really, it's not very sustainable because it's still an extra thing that employees have to do. So there are a lot of ways to, you know, engage the employees, and that could be your communication strategy. Like, what's the platform you're using? What's the content that you're using to engage them? If you send them another long newsletter about global warming, of course, no one's going to read that. They're getting 1,000 emails a day already. So it's just understanding, it's, you know, some of these techniques really come down to just understanding human behavior, understanding the work-life challenges, and then getting that message to them in a way that they can relate to it, in a way that they look at it as something more than just something nice to do for society.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say is the key factor that helps prevent all of these, all of this loss of engagement?
You can mitigate all of those problems if you integrate your sustainability and social impact strategy into your core business offering and into your business structure. So to give examples of, well, between H&M and Adidas, if mm-hmm. you will, H&M had a great communication cascading down from global to local. Mm-hmm. I was connected to, you know, a role that gave me information timely. They were connected to the higher ups. So it was very much like a ladder going straight to the top.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge was it was not horizontally integrated. So on the local level, I struggled to get marketing, to get HR, to get these different branches of the company to work together or to take this seriously. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Adidas had a very sort of scattered approach, and we had pockets of sustainability in all across the company,
mm-hmm.
in every single market in all the different countries. But then the challenge was we weren't aligned vertically. So mm-hmm. global would say something and every market was doing their own thing in their own way. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard for a local CEO to take very seriously,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if he's not driving the agenda, like if the topic of sustainability is not at the CEO and highest level, C-suite management on their weekly, let's say, meeting, then it's very difficult to align and communicate in a way where all the employees are engaged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And where you're checking the boxes of not only engaged employees, but public image, your PR, and even your human resources. Like, you know, because a lot of people say, oh, it's a retention strategy for employees. And theoretically, it's possible, but a lot of companies are not actually behaving in a way that makes that mm-hmm. that the reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, and let me ask a different question, because our podcast, I think a lot of our listeners are either developers or work in small companies, work in startups, are future founders of startups. So the struggles of the corporate world with the communication ladder and, you know, the scattering of initiatives, different priorities of different departments, that's one thing. But what about the struggles of the small business? You know, how can a small business even start thinking about these kinds of initiatives and aligning that, you know, they're trying to survive. They're trying to hire their first people. They're trying to get out of debt. They're trying to get funding. You know, is this the right time to start thinking about aligning yourselves with some volunteering work, with some social impact, with these kinds of things? Or is that, should that always be set aside for the future when we have the budget, when we have the time, when we have the resources, etc.?
Absolutely not. If you do that, you're basically going to be following the big corporate pattern. And keep in mind that they established themselves before sustainability and social impact was a thing. And now mm-hmm. they're struggling to integrate it. So if mm-hmm. you have it already as part of your core business, like it could be any business, right? Mm-hmm. You just look at, okay, what is the business I'm doing? So give me an example of like, what would the business be?
For example, we're designing an app for an e-commerce store, or like a front-end visual side of an application for, yeah, an e-commerce store for mobile. Right.
So you're solving a problem around transactions between customers yes. and a seller, right?
Yes.
So you think about, what is the problem I'm solving? And then you think about, what's the environmental and social impact around that problem and the solution? Mm-hmm. And you will... there will be certain things that will pop out that you go, oh, because essentially what you want is, you don't need to have volunteering weekends. You don't need to have extra things to engage your employees. Mm-hmm. You want your positive impact to society and to the environment to be part of your business offering. Mm-hmm. So it might be something like looking at, I mean, it's super simple, right? Like there's this one browser that, I don't know the formula for how they do it, but instead of using Google, you can use this other browser and it actually plants trees.
Ecosia. I use that browser.
Yeah. Yeah. So I use that. You know, it's really small things that you can do. You might, let's say you do have an office. Well, yeah. So try to make it a plastic-free office. And you're not going to be able to do everything all at once. You mentioned budget, right? It's true. Some things maybe require more money than you have the funding for, like, you know, reusable glass, or you might be looking into, you know, more sustainable materials in your office space, and maybe you can't afford that yet. So creating that roadmap of like, we do want to get here, but maybe we can't do that today. So we're going to start with just being a plastic-free environment, or we're going to start with making sure that we're always buying our lunch boxes with eco-friendly bags. Like really tiny things is absolutely fine. But if you try to do it after the fact, it's actually so much harder. And you must have suppliers of some sort, right? So working with the more environmentally friendly, having these conversations with your business partners, anyone that you would do a transaction with, to make sure that you're aligned. Like, I mean, I know this sounds a bit like cut and dry, but you can be like, are you not a plastic-free environment? Well, then, you know, you're not going to be our number one choice. Small things like that. Or maybe, you know, maybe you won't want to have that conversation, but you at least you're bringing those into your negotiations. And this is the thing. It's not after the fact. When you talk about money, you should also be talking about society and the environment, all on the same level, right?
So I think I have two more questions for you. One is a bit more general and one is a bit more specific. So I'll start with this more specific one. You said when you were starting out as a volunteer in 2011 and then your first CSR jobs in 2015-16, it wasn't easy to find a job aligned to your personal beliefs, aligned to your interests, etc. What would your advice be to young people who are, for example, no, not quite happy with their current day jobs, you know, looking for something a bit more meaningful, and trying to align that with their professional career. What would you say to them?
Please come and take my course. No, I really think, yeah, that's just a suggestion if any of you do want really practical advice on that. But what I would say is it's really about referrals and word of mouth and networking. So your strategic stakeholder, like your networking, becomes super important. You want to know who are you having conversations with and do they have an opportunity for you? And not go out there and like me, but think whose problems can I solve? And you just need to get the word out there, because the only way I found the roles I did was through friend introduced me to so-and-so and introduced me to so-and-so, but I did spend 10 years, you know, networking and showing up for people and offering my services, sometimes pro bono, sometimes it was paid, mm-hmm. but a lot of times mm-hmm. it was mostly just you want people, when they see an opportunity, to think of your name. That would be my number one sort of practical advice of something they can do right now. And then the other thing is, if they feel like they don't have enough knowledge, or maybe I should go back to school and get a degree in, you know, environmental sustainability, blah, blah, blah. That's an option, of course. But another easy tactic I have found is just subscribe to your top 3 or 5 either bloggers or websites that produce content on the current trends around sustainability, because it is changing all the time. It's incredibly volatile, especially now that we've got climate change and plastic this and waste. And then if you're bringing in social sustainability too, it's all the talks about racism, diversity, and, you know, women's empowerment. So you're going to have to find your niche, because you won't be able to be like, you know, the expert in every single area. But pick what is most exciting for you, right? And then just that should be your default reading every single day. You should be, you know, so if you're into materiality, you should be, you know, listening to podcasts and watching things on YouTube that are all around what are the latest and the most environmentally sustainable materials? What are companies doing? Who are the stakeholders in these areas? And just like anything, you just want to basically immerse yourself in that subject. And then that will help your stakeholder engagement, because as you start to have conversations with people, you're going to be like, and they'll be like, wow, you know so much about this.
Mm-hmm. And it just happens naturally, right? I know from my own experience that the opportunity will come eventually, yeah? And the perfect match for your new job or your new, you know, adventure or firm that you're going to set up or anything. Okay, so I think I'm arriving at my last question. And you also touched a little bit on that a moment ago. So which areas do you think are of sustainability in business, do you think are the most pressing for the next couple of years? And to put that in context, because we are directing these episodes at people who want to make a change, people who maybe are thinking about, you know, creating their own startup, their own green startup, what do you think are the directions they should be looking into?
That is such a great question. But I would actually say that rather than the problem like plastic or animal cruelty or whatever the issue is, right? Carbon. Technology for solving those problems is going to be huge. And I was thinking about this because the growth that we've seen has all, like in the last 10 years and in corporate, has always come from some platform or solution. It could be an app, it could be a website, it could be a formula for mapping out where we are, creating a roadmap, and then systematically reducing our negative impacts. So those tools, whether it's something to help you find free water refill spots in the city, or the ability to understand the what percentage of recycling can be done, or where to go to recycle, like really practical tools that customers can use, the average person can use to live a more sustainable life. Actually, this is what I would say, because one of the challenges I saw, I was at H&M, I was like, you know, we're great for our customers. But if I think of myself as just Angela living in Tokyo, I'm bombarded now with, you need to be recycling, mm-hmm. you need to be plastic free, you need to have no waste, you need to, as all those things you mentioned, right? And I realized, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
there's now a bunch of shaming going on, but I have no tools to figure out where do I go to find these more environmentally friendly ways of living. So I would say that technology that will help you practically make more environmentally choices are going to be so helpful for the average person. But then also if you're making any tools that help corporates make progress on any of the fields, whether it's carbon, water, you know, energy, that would be game changing. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's not that most people don't want to. It's they don't know how, or the how is too expensive or too difficult. Yeah, one of the reasons I was really happy to move into consulting on this was also to keep it real, because there's a lot of gray area in this space. You know, like, oh, plastic bag is less environmentally damaging than cotton, but cotton lasts longer. And, you know, you can argue for hours. So, like, oftentimes in corporate, you're not really able to honestly bring up these subjects and be like, yeah, it is gray. It is complicated. It isn't perfect. But let's take action anyway. And so I like to also like keep it real and be like, guys, you know, like, for example, companies who make products, planned obsolescence, you know, meant to break down in a couple years. And then they go out there and like, you know, do some wonderful project for orphan children. And I'm like, yeah, you know, you could make things last a little longer. And I'm looking at my Mac right now because I obviously need to buy a new one. And I'm like, Apple, this is on you. Yeah, I could talk about that for hours, so I will stop here.
Awesome. thank you very much for today's conversation.
You are so welcome. I had a lot of fun, and yes, I will see you online. Thank you. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to the CTO to CTO podcast. Make sure you subscribe us on all of your favorite platforms, and see you next week.